Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Happy Wednesday. During the 1980 presidential campaign, candidate Ronald Reagan asked America's voters, "Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?" That question certainly struck a chord with Americans as runaway inflation had engulfed the nation. And of course, Reagan won that election in a landslide. Since then, it seems that question's been asked by just about every presidential candidate challenging an incumbent. We wondered, what if we changed that question up a little bit? Instead of aiming it at individual voters, what if we could ask the state of Michigan, are you better off today, Michigan, than you were 4 years ago? Let's see if we can get a sense of how Michigan might answer that question as we say hello to Michigan State University economics professor Charlie Ballard. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Cindy. How are you doing?
I'm great. So do you think there's a clear-cut answer to that question, Michigan, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?
Well, there's actually a bunch of answers. I think it's a mixed picture. And I, even though you're focusing on the state as a whole, of course, the state is made up of 10 million individual people. And
yes.
So there are definitely people who are better off than they were 4 years ago, and there are people who are worse off. But for the state as a whole, I would say the state is definitely in many ways better off than it was 3 years ago.
Okay.
4 years ago is trickier because 4 years ago we were in the midst of the worst economic downturn of our lifetime. I looked up the data on the unemployment rate. In March of 08, so 4.5 years ago, the unemployment rate in Michigan was 7.1. By October of 08, it was 9.4. By August of 09, it was 14.2. So
wow.
It had doubled. It doubled in less than a year and a half. And 4 years ago was sort of in the middle of that catastrophe. Since then, the unemployment rate has dropped way back. We've added 160,000 jobs. So since things bottomed out, the news has been generally pretty good.
And I even see in our neighborhood where the for sale signs would sit and sit and sit. Just anecdotally, I'm hearing of friends who are happily able to sell their homes where there was a point not so long ago that if you had, you know, you could have been underwater and you still couldn't move that house and you were trapped. But I get the feeling that's easing up.
Yes, and I think that's a nationwide trend. It's still pretty bad in places like Nevada and parts of Florida, but it looks like the housing market, not necessarily gangbusters, but at least it's bottomed out. I know that according to the assessments, my house lost about 30% of its value in a couple of year period in the last decade. But now it's bottomed out and has started to come up.
So that is improving. In what areas do you think the answer would be, no, we're not better off today?
Well, again, it depends upon who you are. If you're college educated, you're probably better off.
Okay.
If you are a high school dropout, you're very likely to be worse off. And that's really a continuation of a trend that's been going on for 40 years. And if you have a high school diploma but no college, it's pretty iffy and you may be worse off. And in terms of planning for the future, we can see now that the future is going to be owned by those with the more education and training and skill. And I don't think that we in Michigan are doing what we need to do to prepare for that, because we've continued to cut our state support for higher education. It means tuition goes up, means that middle and lower income families have more and more trouble sending their kids to college.
Or the kids graduate with humongous debt.
And either one of those is not a good outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And we continue to have early childhood is way underfunded, regardless, in comparison with what I think it should be, early childhood education.
Hmm.
So, I don't think we're doing the things that we need to do to make a brighter future, not just for coming out of the recession, but looking 10, 20 years down the road.
I hear you say we really do need to overhaul the kinds of kids we're graduating, because we've got that tradition through the 20th century of kind of graduating kids that could go to the factories, you know, make a good wage, let your kids get into the factory with you, and you'd see family constellations. But those days are done.
It was a model that worked fabulously well in the 40s, 50s, 60s, even into the 70s. Not so much since then. Manufacturing employment is down across the nation. It's rebounded a little bit in the last year or so. But the fraction of our economy that goes to manufacturing is much smaller than it used to be. And the manufacturing employment is way down from what it was a few decades ago. So that model, which was successful, and there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
But the circumstances have changed. We need to adjust to those changes.
Yes, because in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and even in the 70s, the jobs weren't going to Mexico. They were certainly not going to China. You know, we're seeing this different world economy. So I hear you say that we still have a lot of work to do to just graduate a different type of student.
Yes. I honestly think that a part of the solution should be just a longer school year. I think when you compare the number of hours that American and Michigan kids spend on their studies, especially in math and science, it's just fewer hours than are spent in most other developed advanced countries. And so when we see that our test scores on math are lower in the U.S. and in Michigan than they are in Europe and Asia, that's not because our kids are dumb. It's just because they're not spending the time that they need to. You spend more time practicing your football plays, you'll be better. You spend more time doing your math problems, you'll be better.
And we really don't need the kids for the harvest and the farm work. Like,
no, I mean, that was the world that we had. We
sure.
built around the long summer season. You needed to have the kids picking bugs off the potato plants. But, well, maybe your children worked all summer in the farm, but I know my boy did not.
You know, Charlie, I do hear you say overall, yes, Michigan is... could say, yes, it is better off, certainly than the 3.5 years ago. Do you think it is a strong trend of recovery, or is it shaky, and could this recovery easily be derailed, in your opinion?
Well, whether the recovery is derailed would depend not on what we do here in Michigan very much, mm-hmm. More on global things. For instance, the debt crisis in Europe. We have the so-called fiscal cliff coming up. If the Congress and the President can't get together on a solution to taxes and spending, the fiscal cliff will push us into a recession. I'm fairly sure that that will happen. That wouldn't be by a policy mistake here in Michigan. That would be a policy mistake in Washington. We in Michigan, even after doing somewhat better, we still, the latest data we have are for 2011, we're 36th among the 50 states in terms of per capita income. We were 40th among the 50 states in 2009, and then we rebounded to 39th and 36th. But none of those numbers is really fabulous.
No, I was just going to say, it doesn't sound like cause for fireworks and celebration.
And if you look at the states that are at the top, it's Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Maryland. It's the states with the most highly educated workforce, the states with the most folks with a bachelor's degree or more, the states with the highest achievement for their K through 12. And I think if we want to get richer, we should emulate those and really ramp up the skills, because there are tons and tons of low-skilled workers around,
mm-hmm.
From India, from China, from other places, and from parts of the U.S. There's so much competition at the bottom. We need to generate more at the top.
And yet we have school districts that have seen, you know, tax revenues shrink and are struggling, and so it's kind of a catch-22. How do you ramp up and do a better job of getting kids prepared and getting them into higher education when, in a lot of cases, your hands are tied because of just lack of revenue and shrinking costs?
Well, we've in Michigan, we've pursued really for 30 years or so a policy that says that our top priority is cutting taxes, and our second priority is everything else. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I just don't think that has gotten very good results. That's why I'm strongly opposed to Proposal 5, which I think would be just a catastrophe, because it would tie our hands in the Constitution. It would tie our hands in terms of trying to find enough revenue to pave our roads and to have good schools.
Speaking of certainly we have the ballot proposals up there for Election Day, but I got to thinking if the question that we're looking at today about Michigan, are you better off today as a state than you were 4 years ago? If you are either President Barack Obama or Governor Mitt Romney, isn't the answer to that question really the key to what will happen for them here in Michigan on Election Day?
I think that is playing a big role. That's likely to play a big role. Now, one thing that's worth mentioning in terms of the presidential election contest is the auto rescue, which is the way that people describe it if they're in favor of it, and the auto bailout, which is how they describe it if they're not so enthusiastic about it.
Right.
Let's face it, it worked. I think that in the spring of 2009, we were really in a situation where there was a very, very serious possibility of a crash and burn for the auto industry, a real collapse, which would have brought down not just GM and Chrysler, but many of their suppliers, and then that would have done huge damage to the other assembly plants. I think that is one of the reasons why President Obama still holds the lead in most of the polls that I'm seeing in Michigan, and I think that the improved status of the auto industry has a lot to do with that.
As always, Professor Charlie Ballard, Michigan State University, a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me on the program.
And here at Stateside, we want to connect with you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. On Facebook, just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. Still to come, with everybody talking Tigers in the World Series Game 1 tonight in San Francisco, we're going to look at the role of female sports fans as we talk to the authors of the new book, Sportista. That conversation in just about 10 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tonight is the night. The Detroit Tigers face the San Francisco Giants in Game 1 of the World Series. The Tigers trying for their fourth World Series crown, having won in 1935, 1968, and 1984. Detroit, of course, blew through the A's and the Yankees to win the American League Championship and punch their ticket to the World Series. And they've had about a week off, while the Giants had to claw their way to the pennant, slugging it out with St. Louis and going all the way to Game 7 for the National League crown. John U. Bacon is Michigan Radio's sports commentator. So, John, is Detroit rested or rusted?
We're going to find out tonight, of course, and all predictions tend to go on the trashy very quickly. So You can add mine to it. My guess is they'll be very rested. The key to the Tigers right now is Justin Verlander, who's probably the best pitcher in the major leagues right now. He won the MVP last year as well as the Cy Young Award as the best pitcher. If he can go tonight game one, that means he can probably go game four or five, which means he can probably go game seven if needed. And that, for the Tigers, is the real key. So the rest probably helps the Tigers more than hurts.
I want to get your thoughts. Do you think that this whole feeling that we've been hearing, this buzz that three previous times one team nailed the pennant in a sweep and the other went seven games, and each time the team that went to seven games easily won the series. Do you think the Tigers can set that statistic on its ear?
Yeah, probably. Again, based on the Verlander factor, the argument going against the Tigers, as you've hit upon, basically, is that when you're used to playing gritty games and you're in a rhythm, then that it's easy to keep it up, of course. The Giants' story is rather surprising. They were down in a five-game series. They were down 2-0 to Cincinnati, and you can't be down anymore.
Yeah.
And they came back to win three straight. In a seven-game series against the St. Louis Cardinals, they were down 3-1, and you can't be down any more than that. And they proceeded to win three straight. So they have faced elimination six times and won all six games. So
wow.
If the Tigers get up, the Giants are not going to flinch, is my guess. The other question is, how many times can you go to the well, to use every sports cliche I know? So we'll find out about that. But I think simply right now the Tigers are the better team. So if that plays out, you'll see it tonight.
What are your thoughts on Jim Leland as the Tigers skipper?
I love that guy. I love that guy for a lot of reasons. He got in the Tigers minor league system back in 1963. Backup minor league catcher who hit .222 lifetime. This is the stuff that major league managers are made of. He was in the minor league system for coaching for the Tigers for many years. He's the guy who developed the famous 1984 Tigers, the Bless You Boys Tigers. Mm. That's Lance Parrish and Jack Morris and Whitaker and Trammell and Kirk Gibson. That all those guys played for Jim Leland in AAA ball in Evansville, Indiana. And he thought he was going to be the next manager in 79, but Sparky Anderson was instead. So he had to go to the Pittsburgh Pirates and then to the Florida Marlins, where he won a World Series, before coming back in 2005. And, of course, shortly thereafter, they win the AL pennant in 2006. So he's a salty old dog. He's a veteran. He looks like he's about 112, based on all the worry and the travel and whatnot. But his players love him. He's a cantankerous old guy. He's funny. When he was asked before if it's time to retire, he said, "No, I cannot retire. My wife does not like me that much." You got to love a guy like that.
And you know, the scenes when they won the pennant of him hugging his players, hugging his son, that picture went all over Facebook, choking up. You love a crusty old bird that wears his heart on his sleeve the way Jim Leland does.
And that's exactly it. He's no bull to the guy. He is utterly sincere. He shoots you straight, which people, of course, his teammates, his players certainly love. What's amazing is, in Detroit, he's been getting grief all year long for an underachieving team. And for a part of the season, they were underachieving, but here they are in the World Series. And then on Facebook and on other websites, I see people saying they hope the Tigers win so Leland can finally retire. It's like, what do you have to do around here to get a little love? It's pretty amazing. It's a critical era, for sure. But again, his players love him and he's winning games, so what else matters?
Well, we will see and keep fingers crossed. It would be great. Those of us who remember World Series wins in 68 and 84, and I am among them, really hope the Tigers fans of 2012 can experience the same magic. John Eubanks, good talking with you.
Thank you, Cindy.
John Eubanks is Michigan Radio's sports commentator. Now, certainly Detroit's economy is going to be a winner with this World Series run. Analysts from the Anderson Economic Group in East Lansing are figuring local businesses will get a $28.5 million boost from playing host to three of the World Series games. Okay, think of the last sports event you attended. Maybe it was a Tigers game. Maybe it was a college football game. How many women were sitting there, really following the action, cheering along as true fans? That question intrigued University of Michigan sociology professor Andy Markovitz and U of M law student Emily Albertson enough for them to research and co-author their new book, Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. Welcome to both of you. And first off, I love this name, so I want you to answer this first. Who or what is a sportista?
A sportista, it's a pun on fashionista, and basically it is someone who not only is an expert in something, but also has great passion for it. So a fashionista who's not only an expert in fashion, knows about fashion, its history, da-da-da. This is, you know, Calvin Klein, 1992 versus whatever, and actually loves it. So we used it as a as an analogy, as a pun, to call someone who actually is a female sports lover and also sports knowledgeable about sports.
Right. Not just getting dragged to the game because your husband had tickets and so you're going to go with your girlfriend and talk while there's things going on the field and you don't care. You care if you're a sportista. Emily, what brought around the idea of exploring women as sports fans?
I grew up with my cousins were my best friends growing up, and they're all boys. I'm the only girl in the family, two brothers and a whole bunch of neighbors. It was all boys all the time. In college, this pattern continued as I lived with houses full of boys. So the idea for me was an easy one. It wasn't really an idea. It was more of a history of experiences like this. So the book for me was, I mean, a great opportunity to be able to kind of tell my story and to read and research about what other people have said about this idea.
The book is about Emily, actually.
Ah.
Really, it's about explaining Emily and others like her.
Other sportistas.
Other sportistas. In other words, how did women come to something in which they were actually excluded for a long time? Also partly self-excluded, and how have they entered this space? How do they negotiate it? How do they live in it? And that's basically what in the conflicts or whatever, that's what we're basically
exploring.
Yeah.
So what has been the key to opening the door and getting women involved in the sports world as serious fans? What's the key?
Well, I think the key is a number of things. Number one, obviously the late 60s, early 70s, which change the political space of all advanced industrial democracies in many, many, many things. And women are being absolutely crucial for that. So you and in your chair and that we have a female president at the University of Michigan, on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So women's entry into the public sphere has completely transformed these societies. And one of them is actually also sports. And as we show, it really changed massively on the production side. In other words, women have now are participants in sports. They run, they jog. If you look at even for the first time, our Olympic team, the majority was female. And in fact, the medal haul, which was amazing, largest ever outside of the United States, was more women than men. So that's one, and we actually have a chapter on this.
Yes, you do, yes.
But what we're really interested in, is again, is the Emilys. In other words, the couch potatoes or the Andys. Basically, the people who follow. And what we're arguing or finding is that even there has been a change. But in fact, women are still different in their sports behavior, in their sports consumption than men. And that's what we're really dwelling on.
We're talking with U of M professor Andy Markovitz and Emily Albertson about their book, Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. Now, you mentioned the difference in sports consumption of men and women sports fans. What are those major differences?
So we do talk about, as you mentioned earlier, the ways in which women watch differently. The typical woman being more interested in the human interest piece and the backstory,
no
of course.
Doubt.
Also a lack of, for example, pregame, watching, you know, pregame prediction shows, watching postgame wrap-ups, wanting to know what happened with other teams in the league to know how to contextualize your team's win or loss, really caring about the game afterward. But the sportista's experience, one of the most important parts is that as compared to her male counterparts, her peers, she doesn't have the kind of credibility, the kind of room to make a mistake, the kind of again, credibility to have opinions. She can maybe observe, but not necessarily editorialize. Her predictions and mistakes don't have the same weight as those that come from her male peers, even though she has proved herself to be as knowledgeable or more so than.
So let's just say she makes a woman makes a pick.
Sure.
It's wrong, and the guys at the office go, well, of course, what does she know?
Sure,
is that what you mean?
This is my experience living. These are my field studies living with all my college roommates, all these guys. It was almost as though if I made some blunder, I made a bad call, I made it, a silly observation, it wasn't even like I got jumped on or I had to pay for it. It was just kind of, there was no real response because it was okay and it was expected. And
it's
nobody,
Emily.
Sure. And when one of my male roommates might have made a bad pick, there was a whole conversation about it. And even though he was getting razzed for it, he was getting made fun of, I wish that they would have done that to me too, because that would have showed that I'm part of the conversation in the same way that they all are. So I think that that is one of our important, in talking to these, you know, my peers and other sportistas, that was a common experience that I think is really important to understanding what the book is about.
Yes. I think, as Emily pointed out, it's women sportistas, the game is very important and the events themselves, but much less, and certainly to normal female fans, absolutely not important, are all the pre and the post game things and the guessing. And basically very few women watch the NFL draft, okay, which is a huge thing for men.
I agree. I'll see that and go, why?
Well,
3 days of coverage.
I watch all 3 days.
It's funny.
Because, and that's, but either, you know, and the point is, also as Emily pointed out clearly, is that even once women have the knowledge, it's for the men, the insiders in the club, they are skeptical of this, or it's kind of almost a potentially even occasionally threatening, or kind of, you know, it's not one of us. And as we're arguing in the book, the reason for this is also because sports fandom is something very, very facile. It's very easy. Mm-hmm. It's not nuclear physics.
Right.
And so men establish a community, which is actually a very powerful one, but very easy to enter, actually. I mean, it's not so hard to know a lot about the Tigers, but to know about the meta Tigers and all kinds of others, and, you know, the depth of it and the history and the stats, and as Emily said, other teams, that already is harder, and that's where the differentiating happens.
I see.
So that's where any group has nothing to do, has a form of cohesion and differentiation. Okay, we are different from them, I don't know, whatever.
Yes.
So in this case, sports fans have that too. And any newcomer is kind of frowned upon. And women are definitely newcomers.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, we kind of almost say, like, she's not – how do you know this? You're actually not supposed to know that.
And I hate to say this because I've been one. I've been a reporter going into, like, the Red Wing locker room to get sound after a game. But you still kind of go, wow, look, as you see like a lovely young woman standing on the field getting sound during a football game. Our minds were trained to expect that to be part of the boys club. But we are seeing some tremendously credible women sports reporters. Or not?
Here's the point, as we argue in the book.
Yes,
but up to a point. And this is also a very interesting conundrum. That for women to enter this world, especially in the visual media, their ticket of entry is not only sports knowledge, but their beauty.
Yeah, okay? Yeah.
And which in turn immediately is also their delegitimation. Because if you're beautiful, what are you doing there? Actually, we love to watch it, look at beautiful women, we men. But do beautiful women know about why the draw play or you know, the pass protection, whatever, and something broke down? I mean, that's sort of a – so, in fact, it's an issue, which, by the way, is not for men. And I think that goes also through the book, that for women, both women sport athletes, sports producers, but also sportistas, especially in this case, the professional ones, namely journalists,
yes,
this is an issue. In other words, how you look, how you – in both ways. And, you know, it's a serious burden.
We're talking with University of Michigan sociology professor Andy Markovitz and U of M law student Emily Albertson, co-authors of the book Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. Why is it that we see so few women becoming sportistas? Is it that our brains are just wired differently?
There is no reason why women should not be able to catch up in this area. There is nothing inherent necessarily about men and women that keeps women from acquiring this kind of expertise. But one of our main points is that it's not an inherent gap in knowledge necessarily. The real gap is in terms of acceptance. So for a woman, it's not about Andy and me sitting down to take an exam, getting our, you know, our master's degree in sports fandom and therefore being credentialed and sure. official and legitimate. So there is no inherent gap necessarily in what we're capable of and what we might actually possess. The gap is in terms of being let into the club by those that are already members, and that's the Sportista's real struggle, I guess.
And let me just, as we close up here, ask, do you see that gap eventually going away and Sportistas are welcomed as equal players in the sports fan club community?
Yes, I think, of course, they're more than 20 years ago, and just like they were more athletes, absolutely. But ultimately, I think it will be an issue of what the Sportistas really want and whether, in fact, this becomes an essential part of their identity. And I would argue it isn't. It's a choice. I mean, Emily is – this is important to her and following, knowing. But it's not a – it's not something that is crucial. And again, I think it has something to do with acceptance and expectation. Okay, with men, and by the way, I should add heterosexual men, being a sports fan is baseline. You're expected to be one. For women, you're not. And this is a difference. So I think ultimately, sure, women, clearly a Christine Brennan or a Joanne Gerstner or on and on, these are totally accepted sportistas and sport experts. Interestingly, by the way, the athletes are the least ones who are critical of them. The athletes treat them as completely as professionals.
Yes.
It's more the couch potatoes, the nerds, the ones that don't do, to whom actually sports knowledge is a form of identity.
Yes.
In other words, knowing, sitting around, it's they who are in fact sort of threatened by
kind
this.
Kind of hoity-toity so, about it.
Exactly. How do you know?
That?
What do you know about pass protection?
Yeah,
why
yeah.
are you? Okay, and that's the issue. Really.
Fascinating, fascinating book. And it's called Sportista, Female Fandom in the United States. And it is out from Temple Press. And we have been talking with the co-authors. We have University of Michigan professor Andy Markovitz and U of M law student Emily Albertson. Emily, are you considering taking your legal training and going into some kind of sports area, do you think?
We will see.
You just have to survive law school, right?
Yeah.
Thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, the history of Detroit and booze. Who's up for some weed wine? That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We continue our look now at Michigan's film industry. Earlier this week, we talked with a Michigan actor who found that film producers, by and large, headed to greener pastures and other states when Michigan's film subsidies were dramatically cut. And we heard from the outgoing director of the Michigan Film Office. She points to the $58 million in available tax subsidies for fiscal 2013 and promises that movies can and will be made in our state. Today, we're joined by Scott Watkins, an economist with the Anderson Economic Group in East Lansing. Scott, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you, Cindy.
Well, when then-Governor Granholm launched the big movie production effort in 2008, the thinking was basically set up a vibrant new sector that could help Michigan's economy diversify, especially after decades of auto-related job loss, and give jobs to Michigan people who might otherwise be heading out of state or having no jobs. Do you think overall that was a desirable goal?
Well, I think the goal to diversify and attract new industry and provide new employment opportunity for residents in a state is an attractive goal and a good goal to have. But at the end of the day, you have to ask what's being sacrificed in order to meet that goal and how the funds to run the program are going to be used and how sustainable that program really is in the long term for the state.
So, Scott, why do you think, explain to us why you think the film tax credit program did not make sense for meeting these goals?
Well, it was simply set up in an unsustainable fashion. It was taking too much money that could have been used for other purposes and investing it to attract very short-term employment within the state. And it was employing a lot of people and certainly employing a lot of folks from Michigan, but it was also helping to bring in a part-time industry, more or less, where you'd have temporary operations on temporary sets and temporary locations. Once that project was done, the industry would go back home until another project came in.
Now, the supporters of the tax incentive say, had the incentive program been given more time, that the infrastructure, such as studios and post-production houses, would have been created. And so it would have stayed put, and people would have been trained to do those production and tech jobs. So it would have really set down roots, and the industry would have been vibrant. But your view of that?
Well, if you simply look at California, where the industry was more or less born and raised, they are struggling to keep film jobs within California despite all of the infrastructure and the years of experience that they have. And film jobs are being lured to other states away from California because of the cash incentives like Michigan had offered. So that didn't work in California, despite all of the experience and all of the assets that they have there. At the end of the day, the jobs will go to where the greatest incentive is, regardless of how sustainable that level of incentive really is.
So how do you think, looking forward, how would you recommend incentives of any kind or support from the state, shall we put it, be structured in order to foster a film business in Michigan?
Well, it's important to note that the credits that we have in place today are set up differently than what they were under the previous administration. Under the previous administration, it was widely recognized that the tax incentive program for the film industry was one of the most generous and one of the most relaxed in terms of process and review within the country. So it was widely regarded in that light and open to be somewhat taken advantage of, and certainly that helped create jobs. But what we have today is an incentive program that directs a higher level of incentive towards expenditures that go to hiring Michigan residents. So that incentivizes the industry to hire people in Michigan, train them, and build up their skills, as opposed to the old program under which there wasn't any incentive for that. They would bring in talent from out of state, bring in set workers, construction workers, get the credit, and then that talent would leave the state once the project was done. Similarly, there's in the new program a greater incentive for using an approved facility within Michigan, which would be a sound stage or a production studio that's already been built or that may be built in the future. So it's encouraging the use of the assets that we have here, and that helps give confidence to those who are investing in those assets and who may have built those assets to continue to maintain those. So the program that is in place today does do a lot of things that the other program didn't in terms of encouraging long-term investment in Michigan's citizens and Michigan's assets for the industry.
And hearkening back to that word that you used at the beginning, which was sustainability.
Correct. This will hopefully build up the talent within the state, build up the experience of the workforce, and it will reward the industry for hiring locally and hiring people within Michigan, which is exactly what an incentive needs to do.
Scott Watkins, can I ask you to give me the economist's eye response to the argument from movie credit proponents when they talk about the multiplier effect, that every dollar of taxpayer funding of movies would generate $6 in economic activity in Michigan because of this multiplier effect?
Well, you can take that dollar and it can create additional economic activity in the state, but you have to think about what else that dollar could have been used for. It's basically taking $1 out of your pocket or my pocket as taxpayers and directing it to this specific industry. Could we individually have done something more productive with that dollar had it not been taken and directed toward this industry? Maybe, maybe not, but that's the type of question that the proponents aren't asking. They're just assuming that that is the best use of that dollar, and they're not allowing for consideration of alternative uses.
Scott, thanks for talking with us today. Scott Watkins is a senior analyst with the Anderson Economic Group in East Lansing.
Thank you, Cindy.
Let's turn now to a little history, a part of Detroit history to be exact. And it's a story that has nothing to do with cars or great music. It has to do with booze. Yep, you heard me right. From its very inception as a tiny French settlement on the river, Detroit has had, how should we say this, quite a connection with the hard stuff. And there was a corresponding push from the temperance folks to get Detroiters to give up their evil booze habit. In fact, Detroit's history of drinking and temperance rivals stories from New York and Chicago. Bill Loomis laid out this colorful history in a recent story in the Detroit News, Booze and Temperance in Detroit's Hard Drinking Early Years. Bill, it seems crystal clear Detroit's early history is very much linked with booze. Start us out with the earliest days as a French settlement under Cadillac, and the drink of choice was?
Brandy. Everybody drank brandy and traded for furs with brandy. That was the commodity of trade, was liquor, and had just a terrible effect on the native populations, especially the closer, some observers said, the closer the natives were to the fort, the worse shape they could tell they were in. And it was used to pay for the furs, but also once an Indian was a little bit imbibed, they could swindle them out of their money. And it was really bad because the braves would come in with furs, but instead of trading for ammunition or pots or blankets that their families needed, they drank booze and they drank the brandy. And so it had just a terrible effect on everybody.
And actually, that is really a key story in the westward movement.
Right.
From the very beginning all the way as far as we push west,
right,
using alcohol against the Native Americans.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. About the only people that didn't do that were the Puritans, but everybody else, the Northwest Territory was very common.
Mm-mm.
It was almost like a genocide in a way. It was just terrible.
So that is a sad side of things. Now, on the social side and living in Detroit as an early French settler, it was part of life, and that did not end when the English came in, did it?
No, that continued. In fact, the English tried to stop it, but it was just impossible. It was everywhere. And the French people themselves, brandy and drinking was a big part of their life. They were not Puritan people. They were not New Englanders. They liked to imbibe and dance and had fiddles and all that stuff.
And when the British came in, you say actually things were even more despicable once they came in?
Well, they had an almost open policy of trying to manipulate the population of Native Americans with liquor. So they would try to just destroy them with the liquor. That was easier than open warfare, they said. So it was more – it was almost, you know, diabolical, really, really horrible.
And people, the settlers, began drinking – besides the brandy, they began drinking that rum that was so beloved by the British Navy.
Right. It went – yeah, kind of moved from brandy to rum, right.
And there were economic reasons for that.
Yeah. The economic reasons were that sugar was cheap, and they weren't drinking whiskey yet because wheat was still quite expensive. Same with rye. And corn.
Yeah.
Those were the whiskey forms. And so they continued drinking brandy until the Americans, really after the War of 1812, And in the 1820s, then it switched over to whiskey.
Because somebody invented the still.
Technology.
Changed everything.
Isn't it wonderful?
Talk a little, and you spell out, Bill, the drinking habits of everyday folks under the British rule and then in the early days after the Revolution. And you actually say kids could be seen in taverns topping up their tankards?
Yeah, that's right. Everybody drank, and they drank all the time. There was no happy hour. It was just happy days, I guess you'd call it. They drank continuously, and kids drank. Grandma drank. They didn't really consider drinking beer or cider drinking. That was just part of dining, I guess you'd say, or they drink that at meals.
And was that perhaps safer than some of, say, water sources or milk that maybe wasn't easy to get because cows were expensive? Or?
Right, exactly. Water sources in Detroit were brought in from the river in basically barrels, and they were rank, not good. So that contributed a lot to it. You're right.
So take us, Bill, to, let's say, early 19th century. Let's say it's 1835, and I'm living in Detroit. And let's start with I'm well-to-do. What might I be drinking in that 19th century stretch?
Mainly they drank fortified wines, like we see in port.
Yes, or sherry.
Sherry,
okay,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet.
And Spanish Madeira. Yes, sweetened wines like that. They would also drink mixed drinks. They called them highballs, too.
So the name even persists
today?
Yeah,
the name persists today. I don't know if it's the same drink, but I know it isn't. But they used bitters, and they would mix them with hard liquor and then usually water or something like that. So it's sort of a not quite as strong a drink.
And then what was – I love the name of this. What was a tansy toddy?
Yeah, that was like a mint julep kind of. They,
oh.
They actually thought liquor – prevented illness. So there was this – it wasn't just to get drunk. It was to maintain your health. And mint juleps were said to have prevented cholera. And so tansy toddies were very popular, especially in the 1830s when there was cholera.
Would a drinker today – let's say somebody is a beer drinker in 2012 and they were transported back, let's say, to 1832. Would that – how would that beer taste, do you think?
That's a good question. They fermented anything. And people didn't really become beer drinkers until the Germans started emigrating to Detroit. So in that time, probably wouldn't get a lot of beer.
Okay. How about the ciders, the hard ciders? Would that be fairly something we would find palatable?
Yeah. Almost everybody had apple trees, and they used them. And same with pear trees in Detroit. Pear trees in Detroit were famous. They were huge, brought over by the French from France. They could be like 60 feet tall. But they didn't make them for eating pears. They were small pears that were made to make perry, which is a cider-type drink.
And meantime, through the 19th century, you describe, there was certainly no shortage of bars. And tell us about the barrel houses and what they called a grocery store, not our idea of a grocery store.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you could get liquor almost anywhere. Groceries sold liquor, so did pharmacies. And they were considered pretty low-end. Really, they were not a nice place to go shopping for booze. And there weren't a lot of – people didn't bottle liquor until much later, after the Civil War. It was sold in barrels or kegs or demijohns, they called them. And you'd bring in your container and they'd fill it up and then charge you.
There we go.
Yeah.
Well, now there had to be a pushback and the temperance movement began. And it did come to Detroit around when?
It was like in the 20s and 30s, 1820s and 30s.
Pretty early.
Yeah, and it started early.
Is that because Detroit had a pretty hard drinking reputation?
Probably.
And it was a big growing
city. And there were a lot of people from New York that immigrated to Detroit. In fact, huge numbers of New Yorkers and Easterners. And a lot of people say the temperance movement began in New York. It certainly began on the East Coast between 1804 and 1810.
And Detroit got some pretty big names, including the famous Carrie Nation, who you say may have been psychotic.
Yes. That was like 1910 through 1916 was when Carrie Nation was on the national headlines. And she came to Detroit in 1908. She acted pretty crazy. She would usually go into a bar with two or three other women from, say, the Women's Christian Temperance Union or one of these other groups. And she would basically break anything that was glass. So she would start wailing away with a sledgehammer. She got famous for carrying around this little hatchet. And she just smashed everything. The reason she was doing it most of the time was because they were selling liquor illegally. On Sunday, you were not allowed to sell liquor. But they were, you know, the police were on the take and it was just done. And so she would target those kind of places and smash them up. She was a smasher.
Yeah. And then we come to Prohibition, which it seems that Detroit had a real big role in bootlegging and rum running as well because of our proximity to the to Windsor.
Yeah, that's always been an issue with Detroit because of our proximity to Canada. We've always had booze, no matter what happens in the United States in terms of social change. We've always had liquor. And really, the rum runners in Detroit were at their peak only for about a year and a half. It didn't last forever. The police basically shut it down. But there was also booze coming up from Toledo illegally, and it came in from everywhere. It was impossible to stop, really.
And did we see a change in crime in Detroit because of – were there gangs? We saw it in Chicago, certainly, and we're seeing – how on the East Coast you saw organized crime rise. Did we see that same in Detroit?
Yes, you did. Not quite as – obviously not quite as big. But Al Capone had connections in Detroit.
And I loved in your article you describe when the 18th Amendment was ratified in 1919, January 1919, that some communities actually disbanded their police departments.
Yeah. You know, by that time it was God versus evil. This was the Protestant – churches and ministers had blown this from just, well, try not to drink so much. You know, you'd be a better person too. Satan is involved with this directly. Mm-hmm. So that's what it became finally. And so they said, well, once there's no more drinking, there will be no more insane people. So there's no reason to have hospitals for them. There's no reason to have jails. There will be no more crime. There will be no more, you know, child beating or divorce. It will be gone. It'll be heaven. And so it was 13 years of a bad decision, but it almost was inevitable. It almost had to happen because we're talking about well over 100 years of people trying to make this happen. And they finally, after all that time, it passed. And it's almost like they had to see what the consequence would be. Because after that, you know, then began Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal.
Yes.
And World War II a little bit, you know, 10 years later. So that just kind of vanished.
So the wind totally out of it.
Yeah,
and in fact,
right.
I have to have you end by telling us how FDR ended Prohibition.
Yeah, he signed the order rescinding the 18th Amendment in 1933. And he looked up and he said, now I think it's time to have a beer. Perfect.
What a charismatic man he was.
Yeah, right.
Fascinating history. Bill Loomis, thank you so much for giving us that that progress through Detroit's hard drinking history.
Thanks, Cindy.
Bill Loomis wrote the recent article in the Detroit News, Booze and Temperance in Detroit's Hard Drinking Early Years. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's engineered by Bob Scon. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. Let's talk again tomorrow at 3, and go Tigers!